Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else, close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is August 10th, 2019, and it's hotter than blue blazes outside where you are, well, I guess if you're far enough away, it might not be hot. If you're far up north or something.
I don't know. There are people listening in Boston and in Washington State, or as they like to say, Washington.
Washington?
There's some Washington folks up there.
Well.
Yeah. I just came back from the Northwest, and the high temperature 2 days ago before heading out to the airport and flying all day yesterday, the high temperature was 66 degrees.
And that's disgusting.
I was a little bit shivery.
That's disgusting. That's just
coming back here.
Nobody should have 66 degrees.
In the middle of August.
In the middle of August. Anyway, if you are, if today is August 10th, or on the other hand, if it's August 11th and you're on the other side of the dateline, if it's the 10th or the 11th and you want to give us a call, the telephone number in here is, if you're outside the United States, there's a 1. You have to put a 1 in front of it. It's called a plus 1, only that you don't hit the plus. But it's 254-773-1400. Or if you're local, just 773-1400 will get you in here. And you can call, you can ask questions, make comments, and interject your thoughts into our discussion of the economy and the markets and things of that ilk. I think start off with what should an investor be doing right now in general?
Good idea. This is good, because this is a confusing time.
Because very frankly, there's something called the Trump put that's being talked about. The Trump put, which is a really fascinating thing. Basically, up to a certain point, if President, this is not my opinion, this is the consensus that's been reported in several news sources. There's a consensus that if the president were suddenly to change his mind and say, we've got this special deal that we've worked out with President Xi and myself, and we're going to get rid of all the tariffs, and we're going to live happily ever after, there would probably be a wonderful stock market boom immediately or shortly thereafter. On the other hand, if the 10% tariffs go into effect, or if even worse, they're ratcheted up to 25, we're probably going to have a recession in 2020. Now, that's the world that we live in right now. Recessions are historically preceded by bear markets. The bear market that is coming is widely forecast by people who study such things and have good track records, and I happen to agree with them. I'm sure they appreciate that. Will probably be a relatively mild bear market and relatively short, what we call a cyclical bear, that's based on inventory buildup. The same thing as the recession. In the bear market tends to lead the recession. It tends to start its recovery before the recession is over. So what should you do about that? Should you do what a lot of people are doing apparently, because there's something approaching record outflows from equity mutual funds in the last few weeks, and inflows into bonds, which is why interest rates are going down. No, don't try to time the market. The reason I say don't try to time the market is very simple. Nobody over a long period of time has ever been successful at doing so. And people who attempt to get in the market and out of the market at appropriate times, by and large, have the worst returns of anybody. The people who are conservative, the people who are relatively aggressive but stay that way, tend to do reasonably well. But the people who try to time the markets inevitably will miss something somewhere, and it will cost them a lot of money, and they never quite make it up. And I've actually observed this occur on so many occasions. I was privileged to be able to watch a very sophisticated market timer for a long time. When I was a broker, he was trading through me as a broker. And I watched his results. And basically, had he bought what he bought at the beginning of that time period, which was some mutual funds, and just held on to them through the time period, he'd had, by the time 10 or 15 years had gone by and he went away, he'd had 2 to 3 times the amount of money he had from market timing. And he was a very sophisticated market timer. So what should you do? If you are accumulating, if you're in the position where you're investing towards accumulation in your 401k or whatever, and you've got several years until retirement, this coming downturn in the market, which isn't certain but could happen, will be a wonderful opportunity if you can scrape together some extra money. But it's also a wonderful opportunity not to get out. Remember that if you have, let's just use a round figure, if you have $400,000 in your 401k and it drops to $300,000, which would be a big, bad bear market, you have just effectively invested $300,000 at the bottom of the market. And you'll benefit later on. If you get out, you will probably get out at the worst possible moment because that's when the emotions overwhelm you. So what should you do if you're actually living on income from your investment portfolio? And again, the answer is fairly simple. Have enough reserve that during the bear market, which typically lasts about 18 months, you do not have to draw from your equities. That means you have cash, short-term bonds, or something set aside either in your portfolio or out of your portfolio. It doesn't make any difference. And when the market really tips over and dips, we use 2 weeks below the 300-day moving average on the S&P 500, but you may or may not track that. But when it really falls over there and you think the bottom's going to fall out of the market, rather than bailing out of the market, simply turn to your reserves and start drawing your income from there and be patient. And that's a hard, hard, hard thing to do. But it is something that we've looked at history and we've discussed this and we have analyzed it until our brains started quivering. And we've concluded that this works. Market timing only works if you can go back in time, and that doesn't work. They should call it market timing travel.
Right.
Incidentally, completely off the subject. I've talked to several people about this, and I've concluded that we really don't think about it very much. Time travel can't work. You can't go back in time.
Well, you can travel forward in time. My own individual time machine. I'm going forward at 1 second for every second.
But the problem is, you realize that if you went back in time one day, what could you do? Nothing, because you'd be hanging in empty space where the Earth was a day ago.
You would actually have to travel as well as time travel.
And you'd have to really kick up some serious speed and do reentry back into the atmosphere of the Earth. That's one day. If you went back a year, the sun has been moving around the galaxy and the galaxy has been moving. So if you showed up at exactly the same space a year ago and you had a really powerful spaceship, the most powerful one that exists today, a space plane or something, you still would never be able to catch up with the Earth before you ran out of oxygen and food and everything else. So time travel doesn't work. That's totally off the subject. But if I could just go
Did
back,
you
and,
have
how many times
somebody have, was telling you that they wanted time travel?
I just hear this every once in a while. If I could just go back to put a date in and invest. If I could just go back. You can't.
This is the whole concept of Back to the Future 2, when Biff picked up the sports almanac that McFly had accidentally left, and then he became a billionaire by betting on sports.
The physics doesn't work.
Right.
Even if you couldn't time travel, the issue is
it depends on the car that you use for it, though.
Well, yeah, the DeLorean.
If it's a DeLorean,
you're already
time
traveling if you're in a DeLorean.
Yeah.
And we have a caller on 254-773-1400, so you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just a question I wanted to ask you that I already know you already mentioned this on your program, that if anybody ever won the lottery, big money, you don't want to deal with them. And my question is this. These people that do get blessed and do win quite a bit of money, how do they wind up being broke so soon? You know, myself personally, you know, I don't think that would happen to me because I know I was born at night but not last night, and I don't think that would happen to me. But I don't understand how you can go through 10, 15, 20, even $200 million and you're broke.
Oh, you can.
Have a good day, sir.
All right.
Oh, it's entirely – there is no upper limit on what you can go through.
Yeah. Brewster's Millions is a great movie. It's a classic Richard Pryor movie. His great lost uncle leaves him huge amount of money. He's required to spend $30 million in 30 days and have nothing left to show for it at the end of it so that he can get a much larger fortune, but he's got to keep that part secret. What I have seen personally, professionally, in people with great wealth becoming broke is We use this anecdote, and it's an anecdote that as far as I know, you made it. I haven't been able to find it anywhere else, and that is the definition of the word rich. Rich is having more money than you know what to do with.
Right.
You might know of some rich people because they have more money than you know what to do with. But the reality is that most people that become successful got to be successful because they knew what to do with their money.
If you win the lottery, take the annuity.
That's generally speaking the statement to give to most people.
And then don't sell the annuity. In other words, when you win the lottery, they don't give you $20 million or wherever.
Whatever the sticker price is. Yeah.
They give you a certain amount of money a year, and it's generally paid out monthly. And you got to pay taxes on it. But what you can do is you can sign over the rights to that cash flow to somebody who will buy it from you and give you a lump sum. And most people do that.
Most people take the lump sum directly from the lottery, or take the lump sum or take the annuity and then sell it for a lump sum. They lose money out that
way.
Now,
if you're an exceptionally intelligent, disciplined person and you want to take the lump sum and turn it over to a registered investment advisory fiduciary organization and say,
give me a certain amount of money every month.
Just give me a certain amount of money every month out of this. That would work really well. But don't take it and say, man, if I buy this, I can pay my mortgage off. I can buy a new car.
But we really did something right at the beginning there. You said if somebody is exceptionally disciplined. Most people that are exceptionally disciplined don't play the lottery.
That's a fact. It's the mere fact that you play the lottery means you're willing to throw your money away.
Well, no, let me kind of flip that. Because what people are buying really isn't the thought that they're going to win. What they're buying is the opportunity to dream about winning.
Right.
And this is fascinating stuff. I recommend anybody looking this up that has any kind of a scientific mindset. The brain scan imaging of activity in the brain of people that are dreaming about winning the lottery is in the same pleasure centers as actually winning the lottery. You get a pleasure out of planning on what you will do with your winnings, and that's what you're paying for. People think that they're paying for a chance to win. No, they're paying for a chance to dream. Because if you think about the statistics, they're mind-boggling. They are absolutely, enormously, stupidly, obscenely bad against you. There's an old quote that a lottery is a tax on people that don't understand math. And that's true.
I also heard it's a recycling of welfare money.
Well, that's sadly a true thing in that near 100% of welfare recipients admit to playing the lottery. So the concept is you have this possibility. You know, this is what I hear all the time. Somebody's got to win it. That's true, but that somebody doesn't got to be you. And that's the thing, is that eventually numbers will come out that say if enough people play, somebody's going to win it. And if you do win it, and this was your retirement plan, this was, hey, I'm going to hit it big and that'll take care of it, the act of having that much money, so much money, causes you to start making decisions. You stop keeping a budget. You stop doing things like checking the balances in your bank accounts or seeing how much money you have on hand. Instead, you do a Johnny Depp. Are you familiar with what he's done throughout his career?
What's that?
He squandered close to $1 billion on real estate purchases and this and that. So he doesn't have very much left as far as liquid money. He's near broke. And Michael Jackson was the same case. When you get used to having so much money that it's never
infinite.
An object.
It's infinite.
If someone ever says money is no object, it means that they don't know what money is worth. That means eventually people will take it from them. They will give them things that are shiny and pretty and take the money. And the people that make money on lottery winners are not the lottery winners. They're the car dealers and the house salespeople and the clothing salespeople and they're watch salespeople.
And you said you couldn't imagine how somebody could spend. Johnny Depp has spent over $1 billion and has nothing. I mean, he's got a bunch of property he's got to pay taxes on that he can't afford to pay the taxes on.
Right.
And in fact, he's considering bankruptcy.
Yes. And he's just won a lawsuit against his managers, his agents. They're kind of agent managers, and they also were doing his money management, which is like combination of things with zero written contract. He just won a lawsuit against them, even though they have copious notes saying that they were telling him all these decisions were bad decisions. They didn't have a written contract saying that they were allowed to be paid. So he was able to claw back 20 years worth of their fees, and he's going to live on that for a while until he spends that too.
Yeah, it is entirely possible to get enough to get when you get a certain amount of money, and there's a key level. I think it may be different for everybody, but once you get above that level, I have a private hypothesis that you trigger a poverty trigger. I call it the poverty trigger. And what happens is somewhere in your life you were told that guy is filthy rich.
Right. There's a guilt associated with it.
The issue is that people who are fabulously wealthy obviously are evil. Therefore, you don't want to be evil. So unconsciously, you revert back to poverty.
Yeah, that's in behavioral finance. That's a very real and recognized set of biases. There's about 20 that fit in that same generalization that you just said, and it's generally a dialogue that's going on inside someone's head that they don't even hear anymore. Mm-hmm. It's something from way back that says having that much money is bad, or
it's
don't
evil.
Tell people. And if you think about it, you win the lottery. What's the first thing your relatives do? They warn you about this. What is the first thing your relatives are going to do?
Ask for loans.
Just gifts. Why?
Because you're wealthy.
Not just because you're wealthy. Because you got it for free.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different lens that's attached to it. They're looking at it from a different perspective. You got it for free. You should share some of that with me. These are the same relatives that would never come to you to ask for charity today.
And if somebody came to me or came into my office and said, look, I've got $12 million here. I just won a court case where a really dumb guy, we had a car accident, and even though he really wasn't at fault, I managed to win $12 million.
I would never take that case.
I would say, thank you very much. Let me think of somebody I really don't like, and I'm going to refer you to that person.
Although we wouldn't say it like that. We would want to have him work with someone professional, but not us.
Yeah, I would not actually do that, because the mere fact that I gave him a referral would probably cause him to sue me later on. But the point is that people who come into a great deal of money that they didn't earn,
or earned in a way that didn't take a lot of time or effort.
Now, there's exceptions to this. When their parents earned the money and they have a deep respect for the work their
right.
parents put in to earn the money.
Then it's their kids that lose the money, not them. It's usually the third generation, because they don't have respect for the original earner.
What happens is the kid, when you've seen your parents work hard, and or you're even your grandparents work hard and do a lot of good, and you have good feelings about them, and they left you a lot of money. You may feel that money is precious and represents the work of your grandparent, and you'll take really good care of that money. But if you just got $1 million or $5 million or whatever,
just dropped in your lap,
and you just got it, and you didn't have to work for it, and you don't know who worked for it, you just lucked out and got it.
You got to pay taxes on it. That's cool. All right, all that's done. That means you don't have $5 million anymore. Now you're talking about 2.7, 2.8 million.
I'm in my 70th year on this planet, and I can tell you, I think I finally reached the point, and it took me this long, and several times figuring out how to get rid of more money than I like to think about, to reach the point where I said, if suddenly $20 million dropped into my ownership after taxes, could I handle it? Sure. And the answer is very simple. I would turn it over to somebody who I trust completely, a fiduciary, bonded, insured somebody, and say, manage this for me. I'd put it all in one basket.
And I would.
And watch that basket. But tell them.
The biggest danger to this isn't that monthly income. Although there's a danger there. It's not the biggest one. The biggest one is the same danger that people have in retirement or financial independence, period, which is unplanned, unscheduled, lump sum withdrawals for this is and that, because it's not part of the plan. It's not part of the spreadsheet. People look at it and say, I've got plenty of money. I'm well within my margin of safety. I'm just going to take this and go do this thing. I wanted to do it my whole life, so I'm going to do it. Well, there's a lot of things that you have wanted to do your whole life. If you do all of them, you will have no money.
The problem,
no matter
actually,
how much money you have.
The problem actually comes up in the study of cosmology.
Oh, dear.
It's called the problem of infinities. If you have what is to you an infinite amount of money, no matter how much I spend, I'll never run out of money.
It's not infinite. Sorry.
But you think it's infinite and you treat it like it's infinite, then you will discover soon that infinity doesn't work.
And caller, we really appreciate your calls. But the very question of your call means that you need to consider it again. The fact that you cannot imagine how somebody can spend that much money means that if you win that much money, you will likely do it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is because not being able to imagine how you could fail is how most people fail.
Well, that reminds me. There's another statistic that I saw this week. The number of bankruptcies in people over 65 has skyrocketed. It's up. It used to be a very, very tiny percentage of people declared bankruptcy after 65.
Is it because
now it's like 25% of the bankruptcies in the United States the last couple of years have been people over 65?
Hmm.
And there's two major reasons that it's occurring. One is they get a bunch of debt, and in some cases it's paying for their children or grandchildren's college education.
Right.
They borrow the money. Another one is they run a big home equity loan, and then they can't pay it back. There's a series of reasons that they get into this. But here's the one that I saw that was most fascinating to me, and it's a significant number of these people. These are people who retired with enough money to live reasonably well for the rest of their life, but then they started taking lump sums out of their retirement plan. In other words, they had a 401k, rolled it over to an IRA. This is just an example. And they had enough money that if they withdrew 3.5% or 4% the way it was invested for the rest of their life, they would do just fine. But along comes something that requires a lump sum purchase, or they decide, since I have, and you think about the fact, if it's 4% and you have $1 million, that's $40,000 a year, which is not a phenomenal amount of money. Of course, if you add Social Security plus $40,000 a year, you can live at a fairly reasonable medium lifestyle in the United States, but you won't be wealthy. But if you're a millionaire, maybe you feel like you ought to be wealthy. So then they go out and spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 on this, or $60,000 on something else, and pretty soon they don't have $1 million. But they're still taking out what was 3% and to use a gross example, if you have $1 million and you spend it down to $500,000 and you were taking 4%, now you're taking 8%, which is not sustainable. And eventually they run out of money and they can't afford to pay their taxes and they can't afford to pay the bills they've run up, and they declare bankruptcy. Now, why do they do that? And the answer is because $1 million is an infinite amount of money to most people.
Yeah, these are the group of people that watched the $64,000 pyramid. $64,000 was a lot of money.
It's actually the $64,000 question.
Oh, question?
Yeah, that was the name of the show.
I never watched it because it was on before I was born. But the concept
that
of
sounds
it,
like a personal problem.
Yeah, well, it is definitely a time travel issue. The whole concept of it is that $64,000 was an obscene amount of money back then.
And today it's who wants to be a millionaire.
Right. And that's kind of running behind the times.
But again, $1 million, if you invest it in a balanced portfolio, well, and you take out 4%, that's $40,000 a year.
Here's the problem.
And that's before taxes.
Yeah, so who wants to be a millionaire? Okay, you get $1 million. Congratulations, you're in the top 1% of earners. You're in the maximum tax bracket. You're going to pay 37% of a big chunk of that money.
Plus, if you're in a state that has state income tax, you're going to
pay more. Yeah, and anything you buy with it is likely to have sales taxes on it, too. So when you have $1 million, this is something that's a really good thing. Let's transition from this to, when is a dollar worth only a dollar? And my statement to that is when you've already paid all your expenses
right.
on it.
You've already paid your taxes.
So a traditional IRA, you've never paid taxes on it. It's worth a dollar. That's not a very big account. You've got a dollar in your pocket. Which one is worth more?
The dollar in the pocket.
The dollar in the pocket, because you take that other dollar out and it's going to have taxes associated with it. If it's in any kind of an account that holds IRAs, it's probably got an annual fee associated with it. By the way, you should close that one quickly. You're probably going to have a negative balance and you're not probably going to get any money if you have a $1 IRA account somewhere, because the closing of the account can cost anything from $5 to $100. Just to hold that out there, a dollar isn't always worth a dollar. Who owns the dollars that you own? If you put together a spreadsheet, it's going to fluctuate wildly with your tax bracket. If you make a lot of money one year, the dollars that you have in an IRA are worth less money. If you make less money, the dollars in the IRA suddenly become more valuable. If you have money in a Roth IRA, it doesn't fluctuate with your tax bracket, because that's a net dollar. If you can get it out after your retirement, after 59 and a half, all that money can come to you. If you've had it open for 5 years, you can get the principal out. It's a dollar. It's kind of like a dollar anywhere else.
Well,
now, it's invested if you have it invested. You can have it in a bank, in a Roth IRA. So we're not even talking about invested money, which isn't money at all. So if you're looking at a dollar and it's in a bank account and it's an IRA or a Roth IRA, they're worth different amounts to you. And when you're looking at a net income or a net worth, if you're saying this is what I'm worth, is it really what you're worth if you couldn't get it all? And that's a huge thing. Recognizing that even on small portfolios makes it so that when you get a bigger portfolio, you can understand it better, that not every dollar is worth the same dollar. That's
and
twisted and convoluted, but true.
It's probably very important to recognize that an invested dollar is not a dollar.
Correct. It's not money anymore at all.
It's capital. It's invested capital. And it's intended to become money in the future, but it isn't money. It's measured in dollars, but that's just a measurement. The fact that you measure something it's a yard long doesn't mean you have a yard that you can build a house around.
Right. If it's a yard long, you probably cannot sell it as a yardstick either. It is not a yard. It is whatever is being measured in yards.
Right. And so the point is that there's a difference between invested money and money. Invested money is variable in its measurement. It's going to invest. It's going to change from day to day. Probably has taxes on it before you can retrieve it as dollars. So it really isn't money. And that's an important factor that a lot of people don't get. Speaking of investing.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting, to me, article it was in the Wall Street Journal, and it came out in several other places at the same time, about some surveys that were done on the value of education. And the important thing to get from that is that about 25% of the people with a college education today who are working, and they have a very high employment rate, by the way, they're much more likely to be employed than a person with just a high school education. I'm talking about just a bachelor's degree now. People with a bachelor's degree, about 25% of them are working in jobs that previously only required and still only require high school education to work. About 25% of the people who paid for a bachelor's degree, and in many cases borrowed the money to pay for a bachelor's degree, are working in a job that doesn't require a bachelor's degree. And as a result, their pay is about the same as a high school graduate. And that may be, and then there's other people who are working in jobs that just have marginally above high school graduate pay. There's about half or less of people with bachelor's degrees are actually working in jobs that require a bachelor's degree and therefore are getting the higher pay. Now, that's not true once you get a graduate degree. People with graduate degrees generally have much higher incomes, much greater job stability and the world of everything. And the key is it still costs a lot of people. There's a significant number of people who are graduating with up to $50,000 of student debt when they have a bachelor's degree. That's unusually high, but 20,000 is not unusual, and 10,000 is pretty common. That's a lot of money when you're first starting in the workplace. The key, and if you have any influence in this, listeners, presuming that there are listeners, is that when a person goes to get a bachelor's degree, there was a time when it didn't make any difference what your bachelor's degree was in. You have a bachelor's degree, therefore you get a good job with higher pay. It's not true anymore. The degree itself matters a lot more than it used to matter, and if the degree is one that is required to get a higher-paying job, the higher-paying job relatively quickly pays off the debt. On the other hand, there's a classic one. It used to be, we called it advanced basket weaving, and I used to refer to bachelor's degrees in marine biology as being worthless. They still are.
Well,
but the bachelor's degrees.
I spent the last week with a marine biologist that was doing quite well.
But she had a doctorate, I'll bet, or at least a master's degree.
Well, you got the gender wrong.
Or he.
And definitely a master's degree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, he with a master's degree.
Right.
Once you get a higher level degree, then these esoteric positions are fine.
I certainly wouldn't suggest to my kid to go into marine biology because he.
I used to say marine biology.
He spent the whole week telling me how hard it was just to maintain a position because there are about 10 people for every job.
Right. But this is my. Now I say it's art history and communication are the most, two of the most worthless degrees. Basically, you can get a job as a, sometimes if you hide the fact you've got the degree, as a common laborer if you have a degree in art history. We have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, this is James. Can you hear me?
Yes,
yes,
sir.
Hello, James.
Yeah, I invested in some land in the Austin area. I kept it for like 40 years. When I was 20, I'm almost 61 now. It's worth quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like around 1.5 million somewhere in that area. But my question is, capital gain tax.
Mm-hmm.
Can I save on the capital gain tax? Number one, transferring some of that to my kids or grandkids. Number two, or buying additional properties. I want to reduce my capital gain tax. How would I be able to do that?
Okay. There's a couple of things to discuss here, so don't get off the phone right away. Number one, capital gains, congratulations, let's say that first. Number one, congratulations. That's a long-term holding of a real estate property. It's worth a significant amount of money now.
Mm-hmm.
Capital gains is the lowest tax bracket of most brackets that people have to pay. So, and this is long-term, so your long-term capital gains rate is significantly lower than your income rate, but it will push your other income up higher because it's kind of rest on top of that. So there are a series of approaches, but the first thing to do is look at what's the purpose that you're trying to do. You're trying to acquire the gain. So at some point, taxes are probably going to happen if you touch the money. At death, there's something called a step up in basis. What is a basis? A basis is how much you paid for it. When someone is calculating a gain, they say, all right, how much did you pay for this item? If it's $20 and you spent $20 on it and now it's worth $30, well, the cost that you had in the basis is $20. If you paid taxes on an additional $2 in the process, now your cost basis is $22 and you've got $8 of gain. So the first thing to do is to calculate your cost basis. Was this a commercial property? Were you renting it out? Is it just raw land? Tell me more about it.
Yeah, this is just, like I say, bought it 40 years ago, just raw land, bought it for like $6,000. Back then there was nothing developing in Round Rock, Pflugerville, Hutto area. It was just a piece of raw land, 5 acres, kept it, and
paid taxes on it for a lot of years.
Excuse me?
You paid taxes on it for a lot of years?
Yes, I paid taxes on it since day one.
Right. So what you've got here is it still raw land?
It's still raw land.
Okay. Your purpose, do you want to spend the money? Because
send the money. Oh, for as after I sell the property.
Right.
No, I rather invest it in long term again for my kids or grandkids. Like I say, I'm coming on up on retirement. I really don't need it because I have other properties. I did very well in my investment over the years.
Well,
I want to set it up for my kids and grandkids. But I'm trying to reduce the gap between capital gain taxes. That's the only thing I need to work on right now.
Okay. So the first thing I would tell you to do, because I can't give personalized advice on the air, but what I would tell you to do is contact somebody that is a fiduciary to talk you through this. Because there's a whole complex world associated with what you're asking. There's something called a 1031 exchange, which is a relatively complex transfer from one real estate item to another. You have to do it properly. You have to get set up. It's generally pretty expensive. Not just the purchase of the new land, but you've got to pay for the accounting around the 1031 and get the people to set it up properly for you. There's usually a legal process. So there's a complex web of possibilities there. The number one thing I tell people in general is determine why you don't want to pay the taxes. I mean, nobody wants to pay taxes, but if not paying the taxes limits you to specific investments and limits your opportunities, then determine how limiting they are and whether it's meeting your purpose. So those are all pieces, not without getting into it personally, and old Baldy instead of young Baldy wants to take a crack at this too.
So caller, where do you live? What town?
I'm here between, I'm actually in Round Rock.
Okay. Texas. You need to get with a very highly qualified CPA firm, an accounting firm, or even a tax attorney, and sit down and lay out all that you're doing and let that person or whoever signed from that firm assist you, because you are in a complex, sophisticated situation. And your advice should come from professionals who charge you a fee. Believe me, there will be plenty of people who will offer to do something for you for free, for a mere commission. A real estate agent will be more than happy to give you lots of advice, and you will be unhappy about it later in many cases simply because you went to the wrong person to get the advice. Real estate agents are good at selling real estate, but they're very poor at giving advice on other things. If you go to a highly qualified, established accounting firm with lots of people on staff, or you go to a tax attorney and you hire the tax attorney, yes, it costs some money to do that. But I've advised people to do that for 30-some years now, inevitably, and I've watched the people who try to do it themselves or try to take shortcuts to get to how to do these transactions. And whoever you go to, and the people who took the shortcuts wound up spending 10, 20 times as much money as if they'd hired somebody. The key is to go to a qualified professional in the area that you're concerned about. You're concerned about taxes. Go to a qualified professional. Do you have a good estate plan where an estate attorney has put it together for you?
Yes, I have a good CPA. I just hadn't went into that detail yet.
Okay.
A
good CPA is crucial. And you probably need to sit down and talk to a good estate attorney. If you have other properties and you have this and you want to leave it to your children or your grandchildren or whatever, don't try to do that yourself and don't take shortcuts. Use a professional to assist you in doing that and let them give you the advice of the most effective way to do it.
It's kind of like hiring an architect when you're going to make a custom home. It's a big upfront expense. You don't even get anything but paper out of it. But the long term is you're pretty
right.
Comfortable that your house is going to be there. It's not going to fall down because the load-bearing structure wasn't right.
And if you have a complex original house, you probably also ought to get a structural engineer. And you're in a position where you are in a complex, high net worth situation where you can get ramifications pop up that are just mind-boggling sometimes. But if your primary concern is avoiding taxes, that's what CPAs are for, or tax attorneys.
Okay. All right, I'll make sure look into it. I'll probably give you guys a call up in Salado, but I need to get on this probably pronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the call. And by the way, congratulations on your patience and your foresight and your wisdom and putting that money into that land to begin with and staying with it.
People talk about overnight success. What they miss is all the years that came before that night.
Yeah, this is like 40 years ago.
Right. Congratulations.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We got about 12 minutes left.
We've got commercials to play. So
I guess we probably ought to play some commercials so that Town Square Media can stay in business and we can stay on the air.
We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join us, the number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We got 10 minutes left in this August 10th, 2019, Hotter Than Blue Blazes show. We talked about college educations.
I'm going to tell you, the whole concept of Hotter Than Blue Blazes means something different to me today than it did several weeks ago.
Well, it's actually not hotter than blue blazes, because the blue part of a gas flame is the hottest part of the flame, and it's not that hot here. It's pretty hot, but it's not that hot. And it's not as hot as it could be. I mean, it's not as hot as it was in Spain and France a couple of weeks ago.
That's true.
It was like 120 degrees Fahrenheit there.
A lot of, and no air conditioning. I was in Portland at the beginning of the trip, and then up into Seattle, and there were a couple of really sunny days in Seattle where they got up into the lower 80s, and everybody was apologizing to me for the heat, like they had caused it or something. I'm sorry about the heat while you're visiting. And this is not heat. Right. This is what we set our air conditioning to when we leave the house.
A fascinating little factoid that may or may not have anything to do with anything. There is a research station that's at the peak of the Greenland ice cap. It's at the highest point of the Greenland ice cap. The research station has been in place for over 30 years. And it has never before recorded a temperature below freezing. But it is currently below freezing, and the ice is melting there.
Hmm.
Now, it probably won't stay that way very long, but it's gotten up to around 40 degrees, and they've never had it above freezing before in the history of the station. And they're a little concerned because they built the in Alaska, up far north Alaska, there have been some really serious problems in that a lot of the buildings that had to do with the pipeline and everything else were built on permafrost with the promise that it would be permanent.
Yeah,
frosty.
That's why they call it permafrost.
And it's melting. So whether this is a one-shot deal or not, I'm not qualified to say, but I can say that it's definitely warmer than we've ever recorded in the far northern climes, which tells me a couple of things. We never got to talking about it. Maybe next week we can talk about this. The Great Wave, Pricing Revolutions in the Rhythm of History by David Hackett Fisher. He said, and he wrote this in the 1990s, that the 20th century was a century of high inflation. As a matter of fact, it was 32 to 1 on the dollar. What you could buy with a dollar in 1900, it took $32 to buy in the year 2000. And that was across the world. And he said these centuries of high inflation are followed by centuries of zero to no, or very low inflation. So the issue is we're seeing extremely low inflation. And the Federal Reserve is not understanding, and everybody is trying to grapple with why we're having low inflation. The fact is, according to David Hackett Fisher, who's a professor of history, was the professor of history at Brandeis, it's abnormal centuries that have inflation. the typical century doesn't have inflation. Now, there's some other aspects of that. The century following a century of high inflation has some economic disruption that's already going on in the world and some social disruption that's already going on in the world. But one of the things that is a big conundrum when we're doing financial planning, when we're planning for investment portfolios and income, is will we have significant inflation in the future or not? And the argument, the macroeconomic argument is we won't, that the inflation is gone. Now, does that mean we're guaranteeing that inflation won't come back and run to some high percentage? No, it doesn't. But the Germans are afraid of it. The Americans are afraid of it. That's why interest rates were pumped up probably a little too high by the Federal Reserve, and they're having to back off on it now as they were afraid that inflation would kick back in with low unemployment. We've got near record low unemployment. And actually record low unemployment for peacetime. And yet we're not getting inflation. Why? Well, maybe inflation is abnormal. Maybe we're in a situation where inflation simply won't return. And the biggest reason, by the way, is a technological advancement, not jobs moving overseas. So that's just one of those things that's worth discussing. I'm interested in hearing what you guys have to think about that, have to say about that. And what else we got to talk about?
Well, let's see here. I was looking at the tariff levels. We're approximately back where we were in the mid-80s as far as the average tariff being paid. And one of the things, this is one of my favorite things to do in studying history. I've got popular mechanics and like the 50th anniversary popular mechanics that was published in like 1952. So it's got excerpts from each of those areas. We've got a lot of science-based journals from back then, and I like to read back. And in the mid-80s and late 80s, when we were dropping tariffs, this was done specifically to counter the Soviet Union. It was done as a trade war where free trade versus regulated trade. And it won. So all of the writing about it in the 80s was about how having a free market would improve everybody's standard of living, would increase tax revenue,
and it did,
would put the Soviet Union out of business in essence. And then we had the 90s, the late 80s and 90s, the boom during that time period. You can look at the graph of the tariffs dropping, and you can see the boom as an inverse of that, the opposite side of it. So the concept of trade and tariffs, apart from making sure that we have a good deal, it's a dangerous area that can take us backwards. So the good deal, I hope we still get that. That's something I'm hoping for. We have a caller, though, on 773-1400. We just have a few minutes left this hour and this episode. So go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I want to know who is actually paying the tariff. Is it the shipper or the receiver?
The receiver.
Okay. Let me talk it through. Let's talk it through from a perspective. Let's assume that you are a small business owner and you have a supplier in China for
widgets.
Well, we'll make it something specific.
Bicycles.
Say you are a security contractor. You are putting in cameras and motion detectors and so on at a customer's business or at their home. So you're able to buy the parts from China and put them together yourself. I'm using this example because I got to talk to somebody who was doing this on the airplane on the way back yesterday. So he's buying the parts, he's putting them together, and then selling them to the consumer. Well, the tariffs hit. The parts that he's buying cost him more money. Well, where does that money go? Well, it's being paid to the U.S. government as a form of tax. He's paying the same price to the Chinese merchant that he was before with an added tax on top of it that goes to the government. Who paid that? In that case, he did. Okay, well, he's not the end consumer. So he took that on, and he said for the past year, he's been eating that extra cost. Yes. With the new tariffs, he's going to have to start raising prices. So who pays it?
Exactly.
So the payer is the end consumer. And
right. Well, then why does the man in the White House keep talking about the fact that China is adding all these billions of dollars to our treasury?
Because you don't have to be factual to be a politician.
Well, good Lord, he's the president. You think he could just tell the truth?
Now, and he may believe that. It's entirely possible, but it's basically the people at this end who pay the tariff.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're out of time. Heartbreak
good,
coming
good
up.
Good question.
Thank
call
you.
Back next week.
Right, and going through that process of figuring out each piece of it makes sense. So until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, the phone number or voicemail is 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to recordings of the radio program going back quite a few years. You can read our philosophy, read our newsletter, see our made-for-radio faces and our wonderful staff, and contact us through there. You can contact us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.